just right off the shore of ancient Capernaum, where Jesus lived and where these guys are fishing. Fishermen have been fishing all night long. You can see their catch here, and they're still catching the fish in the Sea of Galilee like they have been for thousands of years.
I was doing research on what it is that we're going to talk about, and I came across that on YouTube, and I had to show it to you guys because I think that's fascinating. I love seeing those characters like that. I don't know, do you ever watch that show, The Deadliest Catch? Anybody here watch that show? It's one of those shows. I just like it. It's you know, it's boring in the real sense, in that the exact same thing happens every time. You know, I'm sitting around the edge of my seat. Maybe they'll catch crabs. It's one of those things that... But those guys, like in that video there, those guys give you a glimpse of the kind of people. Those sailors on the Deadliest Catch, those guys right there, gives you a glimpse of the kind of people that Jesus went out of his way to find and to choose to be his disciples. And I'll tell you, it's probably a surprising choice for Jesus to make, but I'm so glad that he did, because I just like those guys. There's just something about those guys that's just enjoyable. I mean, they're salt of the earth, kind of middle class, no nonsense, real life people. And I think it's important to remember that those are the kind of people that Jesus went looking for. Forget the politicians, forget the soft-robed philosophers, bypass those wealthy noblemen or the elite religionists of his day. Jesus zeroed in on these calloused, smelly laborers who knew what it was to work a hard day's work. And I just think that's cool that's who Jesus went and found. We're coming back to our study in the Gospel of Luke today. And if you've got a Bible with you, if you'll turn to Luke chapter 5, please. Coming back after I was gone last week. I wasn't gone. I mean, I was actually at home. Everybody keeps telling me, welcome back. And, you know, I wasn't anywhere. But I was working on this graphic novel that I've been trying to get done. We're still not quite done yet, but Riley filled in for me, and I really appreciate that. Didn't Riley do a great job last week? And I'm trying to get him all the applause that he can get, because he's never going to get it from me. But when we left off in our story here, Jesus had just sort of ramped up his public ministry in the city of Capernaum on the north shore of the city of Galilee. And he was teaching in the synagogue. He was impressing people with the teachings that he had. And then he was also doing these miraculous things, if you remember that. He was liberating demonized people and supernaturally healing people. Spent the whole night doing that one time. It was a really exciting time. But it was for a season, and the time came that he was going to have to move on. And so where we left off, it said that Jesus had started teaching in the villages in Judea, which would have been to the southwest of where he was. But as our story is going to resume today, we're going to see that he's back in the Galilee region. Now, to try to reconcile that, we're either going to have to make the assumption that that Luke is leaving some stuff out, just kind of skipping through and not dealing with the stuff down there, or for the sake of putting together a compelling story, Luke is not necessarily that concerned with a chronological timeline, and that's something that I think is a more probable answer. The chronology of the thing is not quite as important to the Eastern mindset as it is for us Westerners. We like everything in its column, in its right order, in its right place and time. But the content of the story is far more interesting and far more important for the Eastern mindset. Either way, we're going to come back to the Sea of Galilee today, and we're going to meet a character again for the second time named Simon Peter. We're going to look at an encounter that he's going to have with this unusual rabbi who's speaking and teaching in the towns there. In our story today, we're going to read about a miracle that Jesus does. But the story of this miracle is actually just a platform that Jesus uses to try to get another story across. And that is the story of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. Now, when I say something like disciple, what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, it depends on our upbringing, it depends on our worldview, what that connotes in our mind. When I say disciple, what pops into your head immediately? A follower, a student. Student is an interesting thing, and I'm not picking on you, but it's an interesting thing because it's a particularly Western point of view for us. We in the Western world, when we think in terms of discipleship, we primarily see it as a teacher-student kind of thing. The rabbi is the teacher, the disciple is the student, and our thinking is that a disciple is someone who learns what it is that his teacher knows, right? The disciple learns everything that the teacher knows and attains to that knowledge. But in first century Palestine, and actually even to this day, that's not the concept of discipleship. That's not what it means to be a disciple. And so let's get a little background. Before we actually even proceed into this, I want to unpack that a little bit to get our thinking more closely aligned with what the original writer intended in this, the idea of what it is to be a disciple. We also have a tendency to kind of think that Jesus had disciples and that was kind of unique. You know, Jesus was this guy who came on the scene and he gathered 12 guys around him and they went traveling around. It was like Robin Hood and his merry men. It was unusual and stuff, but that was actually not the case. It was very common for a rabbi to have disciples. In fact, it's very common to this day for that practice to be in place. They even have a name for it. It is called the Talmudim. A Talmud is a disciple. The Talmudim are the disciples of a particular rabbi. They were the followers of a rabbi. Their goal was not and is not to learn what it is that the rabbi knows. The goal is to become like the rabbi so that they follow him everywhere. And so when we say follower, we don't mean just someone who prescribes to a way of thinking. Follower was held to its most literal sense. If the rabbi got up to go to the bathroom, the follower got up to go to the bathroom. Because you just never know. Something might happen in there that would teach you how to be a better man of God. I'm not comfortable with that. But either way, the average young man in Israel would begin his studies in the Torah at a very early age. At a very early age. He'd begin the memorization process of the Torah. At age 12... if his studies had been advancing, he'd been progressing in that, then he's going to come to a crossroads in his life. First and foremost, he's going to learn a trade, whatever the trade of his family is, by and large, if it's as a family business or as a farmer or whatever, he's going to learn that trade. But if he's been advancing in his studies, then he's going to go on and learn more about the Torah, not just the Torah, but all of the Jewish Hebrew scriptures. And if he wanted to take up a life that centered on spiritual aspects of life, between the ages of 12 and 15, he's learning a trade and he's learning more about the scriptures. And if he decides that he wants to be somebody who's focused on the spiritual issues of life and wants to be a rabbi, then he's going to apply to be a Talmid. He's going to apply to be a follower of a rabbi that he may have admired. And so he would go to him and he'd approach him and he'd ask to be his Talmid. He'd ask to be one of his followers, part of his Talmudim. And this was no light thing. This was a radical, life-changing commitment that everything in his life was going to be different from that point on. And so in effect, when he goes to the rabbi, he's asking him, he's interviewing with him and asking him, do you believe that I have what it takes to be like you? And the rabbi would then interview him, give him a few tests, take a few days to observe him. And then he'd come back with his decision. Either yes, you know, I think you could do this. I think you could pull this off. Or no, you're not really suited to this. Go back to your trade. Go back and continue doing what it is that you do. So it was actually a small number of guys who were going to make it through that process. And that's the way it worked. I mean, that's the way that they were doing things. That's the way it had worked for 400 years since the Babylonian exile, up until Jesus comes on the scene and messes everything up. Jesus does everything backwards. And that's one of the things that we're going to find over and over again. Jesus just doesn't seem to care that much about our traditions and the way we want to have things done. He comes in, he's preaching from his own authority. He's seeking his own disciples instead of waiting for them to come. He didn't wait for the talented and the bright students to come to him for an interview. He went to the guys who obviously had flunked out, because we'll see, they're already in a trade. They've already got their own business. They obviously had flunked out of this process earlier on. They'd foregone a life that had to do with religion. And he goes to them and asks them to be his followers, as opposed to waiting for others to come to him. It's all backwards from the normal way. But as I said, our expectations are not the things that Jesus normally works around. He just comes along and he messes up our traditions and our plans. Like in our story, for instance, Jesus is going to perform a miracle, but in it we're going to see the elements of what it's going to mean to be a Talmid of Jesus, to be a disciple of Jesus. So if you're there in Luke chapter 5, let's begin by reading the first three verses of Luke chapter 5. It says, on one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on Jesus, to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, or the Sea of Galilee. And he saw two boats by the lake, but the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. Getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put out a little from the land, and he sat down and he taught the people from the boat. The shoreline there on the Sea of Galilee, up in that northern region there, is all zigzagged. It has several little coves, which people have actually done experiments sitting out from, people with time on their hands, to figure out how this would have been accomplished. And it is actually quite possible to be a little off from the shore. And you know how that works. The water carries the sound. And so you can speak in an almost normal tone of voice and be a little off the shore, and everybody can hear you from a good distance off. So I imagine the scene is that the crowds are beginning to grow. Jesus maybe has started some little impromptu teaching. And it's interesting to note that Jesus is not in the synagogue now. He's actually out in the open air. And from what I read, that was actually something that was frowned upon, something that was not necessarily a common thing to do. But whatever happens there, Jesus begins teaching. And so all of a sudden people are gathering around and more people are there. And maybe somebody near the back is starting to go, hey, speak up, I can't hear you. Did you ever see Life of Brian? What did he say? Blessed are the cheesemakers, I think. But anyway, so using just a little bit of on-the-spot ingenuity, he jumps into the closest boat and he asks him to put out from the shore a little bit. And this boat happens to be Simon Peter's boat. Now, we don't know if they've met before in this story. I mean, as you read it, it sounds like this is the first time that they've met. And yet we do know from the last thing that we read in chapter 4, he's been over to Simon's house. He healed his mother-in-law from a fever. So again, this could be something that is out of order in a chronological sense. This could be a quick flashback to something that happened earlier. It could be that he's been to Simon's house, but it wasn't that big of a deal. Well, he healed my mother-in-law, but but I would want that. I would want that. My mother-in-law is sitting in the back. That's why. Either way, Jesus lands in Simon's boat, not because Simon asked him to get in. And isn't that interesting? Jesus is standing there in Simon's boat, giving orders, not because Simon said, hey, would you mind using my boat? Or would you, I'd like to give you this boat to use for your needs or anything like that. No, this is what Jesus does. This is kind of his MO. He just kind of steps into people's business and starts doing stuff that we least expected, rearranging things and kind of taking over. That's just the way he is. That's the way he still is. And that's what he does with Simon here. He steps into his boat and he suddenly transforms it from a bait smeared fishing vessel into a platform from which the good news is now being broadcast. Completely rearranges the usage of that boat. But we learn something here. We learn something actually quite interesting. If we look at this as a platform for the story of what it means to be a disciple, we see that when it comes to following Jesus, Jesus is going to use whatever we have to advance his kingdom. Jesus is going to use whatever it is that we have. And that's important to remember, because oftentimes we think that, we're going to get serious with God. I'm going to get really serious. I'm really going to become a follower. And we start aggrandizing that. We start thinking, well, I got to go off to seminary. I got to become a foreign missionary. And nothing wrong with either of those two things. But those two things are the result of a call in a person's life. Those aren't the things that we do to try to make ourselves more serious about following Jesus. Jesus just wants us to put what we have already at his disposal. He's going to advance the values of his kingdom through whatever it is that we have in our lives, whatever is going on in our lives. We don't ever want to assume that we don't have anything to offer for the use of the kingdom, because Jesus is not looking for great abilities. And it's surprising that we still fall into that kind of mode of thinking. Well, you know, I can't really share with anybody. I can't really do anything because I don't know anything. I'm not smart enough or whatever. We never want to think like that. He's not looking for great ability. He's simply looking for our availability to put what we have at his disposal. Well, I don't know how God's going to use me. All I do is enter data into a computer all day long in a cubicle. What can Jesus do with that? You know what? Just offer that to Jesus and let him worry about how it is that he's going to use that. He'll figure that part out. That's not our job to figure that out. All we want to do is make it available to him and he'll use it. He's pretty ingenious, actually, at using the stuff that we would never consider to be that important. He's pretty good at that, as a matter of fact. My son Bradley played football in high school, and he was just an offensive, I don't mean just, but I mean he was an offensive lineman. And the only reason I say just is because those are not the guys that you normally think of in terms of, you know, who's getting the baseball, football cards of the offensive lineman. You know, it's just not one of those things, it's not a glorious position. He was never heralded and congratulated. You know, our team makes a touchdown and everybody ran up to Bradley going, oh, good job and stuff like that. He'd hear it if he missed his block. He heard about it a lot then. But you know, my son, he told me that he didn't care about that. I mean, he just wanted to do his job, and he also had this strong determination to represent Jesus in whatever way that he could, there in that locker room doing what he did. Offensive lineman on a football team. That's the place he found himself in life. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to be able to demonstrate Christ. And you know, I found out later on, I didn't know this at the time, I might have reacted differently, but later on he would kind of elaborate for me the kind of pressures that he was under during that period of time in his life. It was intense. It was intense for that young man to take a stand for Christ in the midst of, well, I mean, you can figure any kind of a locker room environment like that. Just everything that's there and everything that's associated with that. But he was just determining to do his job and to trust that God was going to use him some way and he was going to hold to his conviction so that while everybody else was partying or doing all the things that they would be doing, Bradley was, you know, calmly bowing out for that. And a year or so after high school, one of his former teammates actually wrote me a letter. And it was an amazing thing. He wrote me to tell me what a profound impact Bradley had on his life, in the course of his life. Not because he was real preachy or condemning in the locker room. He was actually quite friendly with everybody that was there. He wasn't in your face about things at all. And it wasn't because he was such an amazing athlete who commanded so much respect or anything like that. No, it was just because he was committed to his convictions. And this young man took the time to write me a letter to tell me that he saw Jesus in that in a way that he had never seen it before. And, you know, following up with this young guy, he's still a passionate Christian to this day, very active, involved in the Christian Surfers out in the East Coast and stuff. So, I mean, it's an amazing thing. All Jesus is looking for is our availability, not our great abilities, our availabilities to make all that we have presently in our lives available to him. To use for the advancement of his kingdom, for the values of his kingdom. He'll figure out what to do with it. He'll figure out how to use what we have to offer. We don't have to worry about that. Just that determination in our heart as we begin each day. I make this available to you, God. Everything that I'm doing here, I put at your feet. You use it whatever way you see fit. All we have to do is yield it. Okay, so the story goes on, verse 4. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, put out into the deep and let your nets down for a catch. And Simon answered, Master, we toiled all night and took nothing. But at your word, I'll let down the nets. And when they had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish and their nets were breaking. They signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so that they began to sink. Okay, we'll stop right there. Okay, so Jesus is done talking and you know, finishes however, you know, those are the kind of things that I would really like to know. How did Jesus end one of his talks? I mean, that's always a struggle. That's been a struggle for me since we started this church. I mean, how do you end this thing? I'll see you guys later or whatever. I mean, we finally came up with a blessing and stuff, but even there, we kind of dance around it awkwardly. It's a difficult thing. I would love to know how Jesus did it because that would be a nice pattern to follow. What did Jesus do? We don't know. Those are the nice details that they leave out for us. Thank you. But so he finishes this up, and all of a sudden, he transforms Peter's boat back into a fishing vessel. It had been his little pulpit, his little platform for a while. But now, you know, just because he used it that way in that moment didn't mean that it was always a preaching boat. Now it's back to being a fishing boat. And I like that Jesus is able to glide so easily between those two usages. He seems to be a lot more comfortable with that than we are. But imagine Jesus having this big grin on his face as he's done, and he looks at these weathered fishermen. He says, "Let's go fishing." And you know, they're kind of like, whatever, okay. And again, Jesus is doing everything backwards. Jesus, as far as we know, had learned the trade of either being a day laborer or a stonemason, construction worker type, maybe building cabinets, I don't know. But here's this cabinet maker telling the professional fisherman how and when and where to fish. That's an odd thing. That's a very strange thing to observe. And it's even more strange that we consider Peter's reaction to that. To maximize a catch, professional fishermen would work at night. We saw that in that opening video. Those guys are out at night working on catching the fish. The water's cooler, there's less activity, so the fish are more often likely to come to the surface. In the daylight, even the activity of the boat is enough to spook the fish and send them farther away. So naturally, Simon Peter is incredulous at Jesus' advice. You know, we've been doing this all night. We came back, we're skunked. This is dumb. And he's an honest dude. There's no religious fakery here at all that comes through in Peter. He lets Jesus know that, you know, I'm pretty exhausted. We've been fishing all night. And I love that Jesus isn't put off with that honesty either. Jesus doesn't, you know, harumph and say, what, how dare you question me? I'm Messiah. He takes that and he, you know, I like that Jesus is not put off by honesty. Let's remember that. Let's learn from that. But Simon Peter doesn't stop with his dismay. He also adds, at your word, because you say so, I'll go ahead and do this. What caused that? There must have been something about Jesus. There must have been something about even his presence or what it was that they heard. They were obviously there while he was teaching. Maybe this is after the encounter that Simon's had with him when Jesus healed his mother-in-law. So maybe he is anticipating or thinking, you know, maybe there's something to this. He's trying to explain to Jesus, like we do all the time, Jesus, you're getting this all wrong. You're doing this completely wrong. I know how this works. You don't know how this works, but I know how this works. And he tries to explain to Jesus, but even in the process of that, he yields to it. He complies with it. So here's the next thing that we need to learn about what it means to follow Jesus. Jesus challenges us to believe and obey even when we don't understand. And that's going to happen to us a lot in life as followers of Christ. On his own, by his own efforts, Simon Peter had come up with nothing. After working all night long, came up blanked, had nothing. Now Jesus comes along and tells him to do something that Simon knows is pointless. I mean, he knows how this works. This is a dumb thing to do. This is just an exercise in futility. It's a total waste of time and effort, and I'm tired. And, you know, this is crazy. But Jesus didn't ask Peter to figure out what he was doing. He didn't tell Pete to understand this thing. He just asked him to do it. And the challenge for him was to believe and obey, even though it made no logical sense. Even though it just did not fit with the way he understood the world to work. You know, that's just one of those things that goes hand in hand with following Christ. There's going to be a lot of times in our lives. It's not going to be a matter of understanding. And then, as I've said before, as Westerners, especially products of the Enlightenment, we want to understand everything. I mean, we don't want to do anything that we don't understand. If we don't understand it, why would we mess with it? Why would we bother with it? And yet there's going to be a lot of times. Now, that's not to say that everything that touches our Christian journey is going to defy rationality. I mean, if that was the case, we'd all go nuts after a while. Some of us would be a very short trip. But it does mean that there's going to be times when what the Scripture commands us to do and what we know about real life, they just won't seem to fit right. They won't fit together. For example, Jesus tells us that if somebody strikes us on one cheek, we're to turn the other cheek. To avoid this turning into some sort of escalated war between another individual, he says, turn the other cheek and present that. And we know that, you know, there's been times we've been in situations, somebody hurts us in some way, and we look at that command and we think, well, yeah, but if I turn the other cheek to that person, they'll hit it. I'm not going to get anything out of this. It won't mean anything to that person. So the natural impulse, the most rational, reasonable thing to do is either to get defensive or to strike back or whatever. Take the next move to keep things from getting worse. Put an end to it by winning a war against that person. But that's where the Talmudim of Jesus have to follow Peter's example here. He didn't understand it. It made no sense to him, but he believed. At your word. I don't get this. This makes absolutely no sense to me. This looks futile to me. But at your word, I'll go ahead and do it. And he obeyed it. Even if he was obeying, grumbling under his breath. Even if he's throwing those nets out, they're going, oh, stupid razzle frat. You know, and suddenly, you know, he obeys. And suddenly, everything kind of clicks into place. Everything falls into its proper place. His obedience produces a success on a scale that he never dreamed of. We don't have any indication to know whether or not this is the biggest catch they ever had, but we can imagine it was probably remarkable, the fact that two boats are about to sink as a result of the catch of fish that they've got. Look, there's just no way around it. Jesus gets into our boat and he ruins everything. We got to face that. Come to grips with that. Our boat is our little boat. We've got it our way. We know how it works. We want it to do what it's supposed to do according to our thing. And Jesus gets in and disrupts the way we go about our lives. He messes up our plans. He screws with our dreams, all the things that we thought. But the result is so far beyond what we could have ever imagined. The weight of our meaning and our purpose seems to exceed our capacity even to contain it. The weight of the realization of what it means to be alive and why we're here and the impact that we can have in the world around us as we yield and obey him. The impact of that is phenomenal. Like the nets that were strained in the catch, our capacity to even imagine it is strained by the whole thing. Our hearts strain with all the possibilities of what Jesus can do in and through us. So our challenge is to believe and obey what he's taught us, regardless of whether we can figure it out or not, regardless of whether or not it makes a lot of logical sense to us. Now, this has a big impact on Pete, and let's keep reading here, verse 8. He says, but when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man, O Lord. For he and all who were with him were astonished. Astonished, that word there carries the connotation that they were actually terrified, afraid at this moment at the catch of fish that they had taken. And so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, don't be afraid. From now on, you'll be catching men. Now, this almost seems like a weird response from Peter. I mean, literally, the Greek, Simon is saying to him, leave my neighborhood and get out of town. It's interesting. The people of Nazareth wanted Jesus to leave because of his teaching. Peter wants Jesus to leave because of his fishing. But obviously, it's more than that. This statement and the use of the word Lord indicates that Simon suddenly realizes that he has encountered a divine presence. Not necessarily that he sees Jesus as divine at this point. That's a progressive revelation. But he recognizes that the world as he's known it has just brushed against the world of God and the way God intended it. And he realizes there's this huge disparity between who God is and who he is. And he's actually afraid. It shakes him up as it normally does. Isaiah had a vision in Isaiah chapter 6 of God's throne, and he actually sees God, and this is just a vision, and he begins lamenting, saying, woe is me. I'm ruined. I'm a man of unclean lips. I come from a people of unclean lips, and yet my eyes have now seen the King. This was the ingrained Jewish piety that acknowledged that sinful men can't stand in the presence, can't be in the presence of a holy God, not just because the sinful man is unworthy, but because of the mortal danger that it presented, the potential that God's righteousness and holiness would consume all the unrighteousness that's there, including the individual. So Peter, feeling completely unworthy of this event that he's just witnessed, just kind of slumps down with a moan and says, get out of here. Jesus, you got to get out of here. I'm not a good man. I'm not good at this stuff. I'm not good at God's stuff. You see that I'm a fisherman. I flunked out of being a Talmid. I'm no good at this. You gotta bail out of here. And I love it that Jesus doesn't flinch. And he doesn't disagree necessarily with Simon's statement here. You'll notice that. He doesn't, you know, this isn't some sort of self-actualization for Pete. Jesus isn't going, oh, that's okay, little buddy. You're not that bad. It's not like that at all. No. Jesus says something so much better than that. If he'd have just said, ah, oh, you're not that bad, it would have still been sort of ambiguous, and this strange tension would have still lingered there in the whole thing. Jesus says something so much better. What does he say? What does he say? What does Jesus say right off the bat? Last part of verse 10. Anybody? Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Afraid of what? Don't be afraid of what? Of God killing you, of God's judgment. That's a great way to word that. That's right. Don't be afraid of that. Stop being afraid, Simon. We got work to do, you and I. We're partners now. We're in this together. You think no one would have you? I'll have you. You think that you're not good enough to be near God? I'll take you in. I'll not just take you in. I'm going to work with you. You and I are going to be in this together, Simon. Stop being afraid. We got stuff to do, man. Stop groveling around here. Get up and let's go. Man, that's important. That's so important. Far from the notion that being a follower of Christ implies sinless perfection, we learn that Jesus loves us so we can be honest about our sin and our failure. Not to embrace sin and failure, not to embrace it, not to become allies with it, not to make friends with all of those things that were at work to destroy us, but to be honest about it with Jesus. To be honest about it with Jesus and with each other. And we can do that because we have nothing to fear from it. Jesus loves us. He loves us. He's committed to working with and in and through us. He's committed himself to that. That should be a huge boost to our confidence. God's grace is not just the thing that operates to bring us into relationship with God. God's grace is that underlying force. It's the foundation on which everything else is built. God's great grace, his mercy, his grace, his love for us that wasn't because we earned it, because we were good enough to receive it, but because that's just his nature. He cares. This is that age-old thing. We shrink back from service in the affairs of the kingdom of God, like sharing our faith or teaching or leading or serving others in some capacity, because we start cataloging our own failures. We start going through, looking at all the things that we assume disqualify us, our weaknesses, assuming that Jesus could never use us or work through us until we get some things straightened out here, until we get straightened out. But we learn here that what Jesus wants is for us to be honest with him. Be honest like Peter was, and that we quit being afraid. Stop being afraid that there's something wrong between he and I. Begin to live from that confidence that no matter what happens. See, when we fail, when we fall, when we sin, and that's the terminology, sin. When we go after our own self-will and that happens, what our enemy does so effectively in our lives is to get us dwelling on that. Sometimes we'll fall into sin and we'll never get past it. It's not because of God, not because the sin was so great that it impedes us from moving forward, but because we're just stuck there. Because our enemy has kept us there. Like, you know, when my dog would do something bad on the rug, I'd rub his nose in it, you know, and that's what our enemy does. He rubs our noses down in that and says, well, see, you're no good at this. You can't do this. You can't follow Jesus. You're not worthy. You're not able to be there. And as long as we buy that, as long as we listen to that, and run around in that futile attempt of thinking, well, I'm going to get some things together. I'm going to get my act together. I'm going to get this right, and then I'll be back in stride with God. We're not going to get anywhere. What God is expecting, what Jesus reveals, even in this short statement, is that when we fail, when we sin, we acknowledge it. God, I screwed up there. That was way wrong. That was so wrong. I'm so sorry. I know that you've made me better than that. And then we move right on from there. As though nothing ever happened, because that's God's perspective. As though nothing ever happened. As though nothing ever happened. That's a challenge. That's not easy to do. That's real easy to stand up here and get excited about, but it's not an easy thing to do when we're confronted with the emotions and the struggle of that failure. And then there's a lot of times that we're not very good for each other in the process, because we have a real difficult time letting somebody move on from some sin or some problem. We have a tendency to want to keep them right there as well. But we learn the other side of that too as we deal with each other. We got nothing to fear from Jesus. We got nothing to fear with him. Let's make sure that our attitudes and our hearts towards each other is that we have nothing to fear there either. Okay, I'm way off my notes. I'm going to just take a minute here to figure out where I am. You know what? We'll just move on. We get down here. We get to verse 11. We'll finish up with that. He says, and when they had brought their boats to land, all these guys, they left everything and they followed him. These guys just caught what has possibly been the biggest haul of their lives. This was a boon to business. This kind of thing could bolster their reputation as the greatest fishermen in all of northern Galilee, the whole region there. But instead of capitalizing on that event, instead of making a little logo with Jesus standing over a net or something like that, and creating a business opportunity out of that, it says, and this is so important, instead of capitalizing on what's happened here to go ahead and establish their own goals and dreams, it says they left everything. And so let me just make a quick point about this. We have to realize that to follow Jesus is to leave our former lives behind completely. As I said before, it doesn't mean that we're going to quit our jobs. It doesn't mean that we have to go off and become missionaries or monks. But it meant that all the way that we once understood our identity, all the ways in which we had once understood our goals and values in life, now have to be understood as the goals and values of Christ. We yield all of that to him. We no longer just go down the path of life as though nothing has changed. Everything has changed. For Talmudim, it was life-changing. It was radical in its alteration. We follow him, not our own will or plans for life, but his. We follow and embody his teachings so that we don't sit down and just try to figure out what's going to be the best thing for me in every situation that we find out. But what is it that Christ has taught us? What is it that he desires? Looking at the values of life from that perspective. I was just reading the blog of a friend of mine who had gone to apply for a job somewhere, and he's a filmmaker, and the job was going to entail him having to work inside the strip clubs and stuff. And from his perspective, it was a great job. It was going to have benefits that he needed for his young family. But he determined at that point, I'm going to do what I know is right here. I'm going to yield my life to Christ's values and not just embody the values of this world in order to promote my own well-being. That's a hard lesson to learn. I'm speaking specifically, those are his convictions. I certainly agree with them. I think they're absolutely the right thing to do. And oftentimes it's going to mean that we're going to have to do what we know is right, even if we don't know what the outcome is going to be. Because we've yielded our lives to him. We're following the rabbi. We're the Talmudim of Christ. So we're going to make our choices and our decisions based on what his values are, of his righteousness, of his love, of his grace. I think about these guys standing there in the midst of this giant haul of fish that they had to get to market before it was going to spoil. And the implication from the text is, standing there in the midst of all of this fish that Jesus caught, they bail on it. They walk away from it. They left it and followed him. And the message to us seems to be that there's just something more important going on than the stuff that we can gather up here that eventually spoils. There's something far more important going on. It's far more important to our lives. To be the Talmudim of Jesus means more than just listening to a little bit about him on a Sunday morning. It means to become like him, to leave our former way of understanding of ourselves, of our understanding of this world that we're in, and embrace, believe, and obey what it is that he's revealed about who we are and why we're here and where we're going. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so what did we learn here? We learned that to be Jesus' disciple, his follower, we need to make what we have available to him. It doesn't require some special ability, just our availability. And we have to learn to believe and obey regardless of our understanding, regardless if it seems to go against the flow of what we've always understood. And that we can be honest about our shortcomings with Jesus because he loves us. It doesn't mean that we're called to sinless perfection, but we are called to honesty. And from that place of honesty, we can have confidence in life. And we have to determine to walk away from our former way of life, from our former self-oriented point of view. Now for some, and I'm going to say for some here this morning, that's a challenge that has yet to be taken up. For some here today, this is kind of a casual thing that you've been involved in. This is just kind of something you've been rolling with because, well, either the family rolls with it or it's just something that I've been doing to kind of make myself feel better about life. And I like this place because they don't hassle me. But I'm telling you right now that the challenge was just presented there in the Word. And what we do with that challenge is all important. What we do when we leave here today is monumentally important. To make that commitment in our lives, to make that determination, I'm following you. I'm your disciple. I want to be like you. I can't stress that enough. And I'm asking you, with all the love in my heart that I have for you, take it seriously. Take it seriously. Every one of us, take it seriously. Because ultimately, it comes down to a choice between life and death. And I don't mean that in some judgmental sense. I mean that in terms of the life that we experience right here and right now. The difference between life and death. We can't operate any longer from the perspective that there is an alternative. Because there is no alternative. There is no alternative. There is nothing else. Nothing. Take it seriously. God, we just ask you to work that into our lives and our hearts. We ask you, dear Jesus, to make that clear to us. And that stirring that we feel, that sense that we acknowledge that deep inside of us, Father, just draw that out of us. Bring it to the surface and help us to live from that. Awaken our hearts, God. Awaken us to the reality of new life in you and what it means to follow you and serve you. I pray that you do that for each individual here, Lord God. As we take this moment, even as we sing here, I pray, Lord, that you by your Spirit challenge us and cause us to step up to the next level. To draw us deeper into relationship with you. I pray this for us, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. If you guys will stand with me, please. Ruth is going to be down here to pray for anybody who may need prayer for anything. And I'll be down there afterwards.
Draw me close to you. Never let me go. I lay it all down again to hear you say that I'm your friend. Lord, you are my desire. No one else will do. There's nothing else could take your place. Feel the warmth of your embrace. Help me find a way. Bring me back to you. You're all I want. You're all I've ever needed. Let me go. I lay it all down again to hear you say that I'm your friend. Lord, Lord, you are my desire. That no one else will do. Nothing else could take your place. To feel the warmth of your embrace. So Lord, help me find a way. Bring me back to you.
Speak this blessing on each other. May Christ be a light to illumine and guide you. Christ be a shield to overshadow you. Christ be under you. Christ be over you. Christ beside you, on your left and on your right, both in this world and the one to come. Go in peace, you children of God.